I literally use whatever I was drinking.
Charge the ion accelerator. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host, Bale of Lost Souls Podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Hi everybody.
Tanya Gates and Red Powell.
Hello.
Hey everybody.
We got a great show this week. I have some hobby tips. Turn this segment, the hobby segment, into a segment of hobby tips where you can get by with having no talent, no excuses, very little cash. Thought a lot about these. You got to stay tuned till after the break to hear about them, though. Last week, we talked about, there was a couple things. You were asking for base suggestions, Adam. Did you?
Yeah.
Did you put any of those into effect?
I did. I actually did a bit of everything you guys said. I went to a hardware store and I bought some just metal rod. I think it's about 10 mil thick metal rod, or maybe, yeah. And I just cut a length that was the exact same height as the flight stand and drilled it through the base. And so it sits flush. When the base sits on the ground, it sits flush. And then I used like a third of a bottle of super glue on each one, but I was doing three speeders and I just super glued the absolute crap out of them. And then because the basing structure I have is a bunch of clay and real slate, I wedged it in with slate pieces, which I then PVA'd on top of the super glue, like craft glue, I guess. I don't know if you guys call it PVA over there. And then I put clay over that, and those things, they ain't going to budge for nothing. So it's kind of the reverse. You know, you said you pour the resin under the base to lock it all in. Mm-hmm. I realized I was almost doing that same thing on top of the base anyway with my basing material. So mm-hmm. I thought, oh, well, I'll save myself a bit of time and just lock it in at the bottom. But then the actual structure is going to be on top of the base, but it's going to be hidden by, you know, it goes slate, then clay, then texture paint, and then, you know, you paint the thing. And it came out really good, like really, really happy with it. Great tips.
Heck yeah. Solid on there. I mean, it's a...
Oh, I could hit a bloke with it. It you know, it wouldn't break.
Nice. Yeah, glad to hear it. That's it's one of those things, you know, it's a difficult thing sometimes trying to figure out how to transport your army and play with it and
yeah,
keep it height appropriate.
I played them on the weekend as well. Like I played that with those models, and man, anybody who's got the Storm Speeders hanging out, because they weren't like the most loved miniature for a while. Whichever variant you've got, crack it out, give it a go. Like with Armor Contempt, they're really a lot more durable. And I was running the Thunderstrikes. Man, the damage output of them is really impressive. Having that Blizzard skill 2+, and then essentially just like three las cannon shots a piece hitting on twos, and then like 2d3 auto cannons, they do a lot of work.
Man, mark my words, I think that in 2 or 3 weeks we'll see a ton of Thousand Suns and Grey Knights on the table.
That's yeah. I'm a bit fearful of Grey Knights. Grey Knights because I think they're going to come and eat me, like in my deployment zone. T-Suns more because I think they're going to stand there and there's nothing I can do about it. Like, yeah.
So I also say I think we'll see other armies because of that have like a resurgence of rhinos.
Oh yeah, exactly. That's a great point. You just jam in front of them, turn on your. I suppose funny enough, there's a strat called Armor of Contempt that gives your vehicles like the 5+ if you're not painting against mortals and stuff. It's actually quite a good play at the moment into some of these things. So yeah, a lot of stuff out there is going to see. Well, people doing what you always champion, Paul. You know. Go through your book again, reevaluate, reassess.
Well, we're going to see the psychic phase like just be a super thing again. And it's been always a kind of right there on the wings in the shadows lurking. But now with Eldari and Army of Contempt, it's kind of buffing up Thousand Suns and Grey Knights specifically that we'll see psychers come back en masse. Tyranids as well.
Tyranids is a big reason to have a look at all your psychic defenses. And the fact that like T-Suns and Grey Knights got a lift from this is big, because hopefully they'll keep some of the Tyranid menace in check, because I feel like they're probably the best thing in the game at the moment is Tyranids.
You're probably right. But also I think we'll have people looking at what is the cheapest like points per wound thing they can figure out to put in their army to just absorb smites.
That's a big call.
So I mean, again, another excuse to go back and check out the book, whatever book you're playing with, and see if there's anything in there. Like if it can move slightly faster than the rest of your army. You know, that checks off a box. Does it have a good point to wound ratio? Checks off another box. Does it have some other kind of benefit, such as like a rhino, which has the benefit of being kind of tough,
mm-hmm.
a little bit durable, and can hold your dudes? Yeah, it's a weird world. I think this is going to be a very interesting next few weeks as far as what people are putting on the tabletops.
100%. You'll be, between the four of us, three of us play Guard as one of our most favorite beloved factions. I think that's correct, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
You are correct.
So I don't buy too much into win rates because I think the win rates can go up and down for a bunch of reasons, different player packs, different events at different times, et cetera, et cetera. But Guard's win rate went down over the weekend. after getting the hammer of the Emperor buff from the balanced data slate, their win rate went down.
There are a variety of things that can contribute to that. It's like, how does everyone on every faction have a 57% win rate? And because they all just be Guard.
Well, I can tell you almost exactly what I think it is. It's that bunch of people who haven't played Guard in, you know, up to a couple of years jump back on Guard because they were like, oh my God, I get to play my Guard again in this new thing. And they've all forgotten how to play Guard. So this is the first weekend back with a new faction for a bunch of people who haven't been there in a long time.
That's probably true. And then also you got to dial it in to figure out what that right ratio balances of free equipment is.
I think also, like, if we look at which factions Guard was doing well against, like Chaos Space Marines was one that was like, I think that they had a 50% win rate against, but now they get Armor of Contempt, right? So it's even harder now for Guard to sort of compete into those historically, I don't want to say like easy factions, but I think that they were well-matched factions.
I do agree with that for sure.
With the idea that Psykers may come back, you know, Red, how you feeling over there?
I mean, Psykers coming back. I think that if GW's done anything for us, they've continued to keep this a pretty exciting roller coaster for 9th edition. And so Psykers coming back, maybe there's a resurgence of Khorne in the near future. We'll see.
So I wanted to get the World Eater's perspective over there. And we talked a little bit about it on the last show about how, you know, the knights, you know, when you give up the Psyker from the Warhammer community article, is that, you know, you get the plus one attack.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, the knights, I mean, the addition of plus one to weapon skill, not just plus one to hit, but plus one attack and plus one weapon skill, that there can be a lot attached to that. I'll take that if they take away my Psyker abilities for demon princes. That's pretty good trade off.
Yeah, fair enough. It's just going to be, I don't say it's the Wild West out there, but we're going to continue to feel the ripples of this data slate, which is probably a good thing. I mean, I think it's tuned things enough where if people are craving that efficiency, that they can, you know, make changes to their list, but it's also broken up, you know, what the landscape is, what the top 5-10 tables are going to look like. You might see some different lists or some different factions on there than you saw 3 weeks ago.
I think that's a huge point in the matter of creativity. And by achieving a point of innovation amongst the meta, it's not just, okay, well, I'm going to supercharge this. I think that the data slate with Armor of Contempt giving such a broad range of units, I mean, I can't say everybody got necessarily a buff here or there, but there was quite a bit across the board. And then with the soon to come, you know, Knights and Chaos Knights, and then on top of that, we got the preview of the Chaos Space Marines just beyond that. I think that there's a lot to play with right now, and as we prepare going into the next quarter, I guess you could say.
Man, what a world. It's like, I've heard people winning out there with the Chaos Space Marine factions as well. I feel like even Noise Marines did pretty well.
There's a lot to say for Noise Marines are an interesting one. It's more the Emperor's Children as a Chaos subfaction. I think it's really well poised. They still have one of the, like, oh jeez, they've got two of the best stratagems in existence that they've ever printed, which is Veterans of the Long War and Honor the Prince. Which Honor the Prince means on any, you can count any one of the dice on any charge roll as a 6 automatically, meaning you just need to roll a 3 with a reroll on one dice to make sure you make a charge from reserve. And then, of course, you've still got Terminators that can pack all the AP3 and AP4 shooting you need now to kill other things with Armor of Contempt. So you can just take one unit of Terminators that can just come down, kill ice two Marine units, and then auto-charge into a third and kill that one too. They just seem like the multi-purpose tool, like the Swiss Army knife right now. The only issue is their durability is still pretty, well, crappy compared to other Terminators out there, to loyalist Terminators.
As it should be.
I don't know about that. I mean, they deserve their third win. As soon as they get their third win, it's all fine. It's all fine in games.
Is AP3 that new, like the chase card?
It is, yeah. AP1 and 2, unfortunately, don't card it anymore. Because AP2, shooting a Marine in cover, they still take a 3 up. Because, of course, 2 goes to 1, and then the cover makes up for the last pip. So AP3 is the sweet spot. But, man, like, Blood Angels are licking their chops. Because they've got AP4, you know, they can put themselves into Assault Doctrine very easily to get AP4 and all their power weapons, Vanguard. Vanguard Vets with Power Swords now, which I think is actually a pretty good pick. If you've got a couple laying around, you can take a Power Sword and a Chainsword, or a Lightning Claw and a Chainsword.
Yeah, so what's the AP on the Lightning Claw?
It goes from 2 to 3 in Assault Doctrine. Yep. So once again, they get to that sweet AP3, and you can drown people on AP4 as well if you want to. So man, it's a whole new world out there for a lot of people. But see, there's a funny juxtaposition here. Everyone's going to be worried about their AP all the time. Like, how much AP can I get? Oh, where is it? And they've got NIDs entering from stage left and being like, we function off toughness and the amount of wounds we got. Have all the AP in the world. We only had a 4+ anyway, you know?
I mean, maybe that's where Lightning Claws just are the best of both worlds.
It's true. That's a good point.
I mean, because the extra attacks and the wounds, the wounding ability. And then it doesn't feel to me that the AP is built into the cost of it. Like you're getting you'd pay for the reroll, the wound ability.
The value buys the reroll to wound for sure. And I mean, the same you said for craft worlds. Craft worlds don't care how much range you got. They just care about the number of attacks. You have more than a handful of attacks, you're probably killing their squad, whatever it is. Even if you're just punching them with, you know, strength 3, AP nothing. Like I was looking at Katachan, I'm like, man, Katachan could just run up and kill some aspect warriors, no problems.
Well, we knew that.
Yeah. But once again, they function off, you know, either not being there to be shot or charged, or just having, you know, minus to hit and fly up invulns and things. So it's funny how, like, all the power armor, everyone's stacking all this AP for power armor, and we might just be going in the wrong direction, you know, in a couple of months from now, when if this wave of Armor of Content damage recedes, we'll just be like, AP2 is fine, you know, because it covers all bases.
I don't think it will, though. I think that they're going to be a thing, you know, well, let's just say for the next quarter, you know, until we see it, they could easily decide that that was too aggressive.
Good segue. Well, in addition to that, we've seen the GW can like give it and take it away with these data sheets. We've got the chapter approved coming in a couple of months, which could rebalance some points as well. But the biggest issue, the biggest reason I think all this stuff is sticking around is because it's what you need to go into Knights as well, which is like looming, like the building models they are.
Yeah, Knights are tough to get right from what we've seen from editions past. So it'd be fun to kind of break them down whenever we get the opportunity to do so.
But, you know, like Lightning Claw does, you know, one half of nothing versus a toughness 8 knight.
I mean, unless you're a Blood Angel.
That's true. Literally Blood Angels only. And maybe White Scars. Going to damage 2 is pretty good. But winning on 6 is re-rolling for us lowly, you know, Dark Angels and the rest. Not quite what you want.
That's right. So yeah, I guess you're forced to kind of go with the hammers, and then you might just get outmaneuvered. Mm. Well, look, I'm happy that we can even have this discussion. The fact that we can sit here and talk about what are, you know, Marines and Lightning Claws and Dark Angel Terminators with, what is it, Maces of Absolution or whatever, get to play with a modern codex.
Yes, spot on. We actually get to go back to the drawing board. And that's one of the funnest things about the hobby. I just came from an event. I played in an event on the weekend, and that post-event fever has got me good, and I'm churning and looking for new bits and pieces and seeing where I went wrong in those games and trying to take new tech and paint some new models up. I'm sitting here building and magnetizing 10 Relic Terminators as we speak.
For the extra invul, or like what's?
Oh, because they're cheap. They're the cheapest Terminator body you can have. And as Dark Angels, there's a ceiling. So you get to a certain amount of like everything's perma transhuman with a 2+. Whatever, that you just need the cheapest wound per point you can get in that slot. And because you can take a Lightning Claw and a Combi Bolter instead of having to take a Power Fist and a Storm Bolter, you get them at a bit of a discount on the Relic Termies over the regular Deathwing ones or the standard Assault ones. And plus, they're not bad. Like, they're still not bad. It's still just a bunch of bolter shots, a bunch of lightning claw shots, all very hard to chew. Got a couple of, I built a couple of, you'd love this. I converted a couple of Reaper autocannons because they're like Terminators. They got the old 30K ones. There was a turret, that autocannon turret, the quad autocannon turret that came with the Aegis defense line. I've never used it. I've used the defense line, but I've never used the turret. I had it stuck together and built, but I cannibalized it to make my Reaper autocannons. I cut them up individually. Into four individual ones, and then I shortened the barrel by half, so now it's like
what's the size of that thing?
It's way too long otherwise, because it's taller. Those autocannons are taller than the actual Terminators, so I had to shorten the muzzle. But as soon as I did, it looks sick. It's like this short barrel autocannon. It looks really cool.
Oh, nice. I like the mother of invention. There is a necessity.
Necessity. Yeah,
but don't they get an extra? Like, they have a 4+ invulnerable save?
No, not anymore. Okay. Now it's just pretty much exactly the same as a regular Terminator. But
it's been how long has it been since I looked at him with a...
Yeah, they don't get Thunderhammers or Storm Shields. Unfortunately, unlike Chaos Terminators, I don't get to have the Combi Plasm, Combi Melter and stuff like that, because I would take those, a couple of those at least in a heartbeat. So they just get like regular Terminator stuff, so lightning claws, power fists. Yeah, lightning claws, power. Maybe they do get actually, and some different weapons, like no cyclones, no assault cannons, because they're newer weapons. They get like Reaper water cannons, heavy flamers, stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I can see the choice. Makes sense.
Yeah, they're cool.
I have been looking at the guard though. It seems like there's something there.
It's fun. It's fun, and there's still. So one of the things I noticed about the guard rules, I think you can still. Please, Red or Tanya, correct me if I'm wrong. I think you can still soup. Like, you could take Marines and guard, and still, as long as you're mono Cadia, you'll still get Hammer of the Emperor. It's when you soup internally within the guard book, you lose that. Because I had somebody point out to me you could take Custodes and guard and still get all the benefits. You'd only lose the Katar portion. Thanks for telling me, Red. There's some opportunities there for guard. If mono guard isn't doing it for you, you still get all your goodness, and you can go and take some other bits and pieces elsewhere if you need to.
Maybe those mortars. Like, I don't know. Maybe mortars just don't get it done either, you know, with the low strength.
I like one unit of mortars because you got that nice plus one to hit, plus one to wound strat from Psychic Awakening. That's still actually really nice. But I've got 27 mortar teams. I don't know how many you guys have got, but I've got a lot. So
I think it's a couple. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love volume, and I think it's a huge deal. I just recognizing that there is no AP associated with it, you just kind of have to resign yourself to that and roll out because you need the volume.
Yeah. Well, what I like one squad forward, that plus hit and wound, is because you make him Cadian, of course. You stand still, and with an order, you do four rolls to hit. And then one unit is very inexpensive, but gives you a great tool into Eldar bodies. You want to pop some Harlequins sitting on an objective. You know, you don't want to use a Manticore to go after that target. You can use something far cheaper that with just an order and a strat is pretty reliable at getting the job done. Because they'll hit on threes re-rolling, and then they'll wound on twos with 3d6 shots. Pretty good for those for the points cost. I like one squad. I'd probably take one squad in almost every guard list. Any more than that, it's just a taste, I think.
Just as like a heavy weapon squad, is it?
Yeah, because I mean, you're always going to want to take one or two Manticores in a battalion. So you've usually got that third one free, that third heavy support slot free. So I usually like to take one squad of three mortars. 18
points on mortars or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly. Who cares? Oh. You know, stop breaking the bank.
It's 50 points there.
Oh,
yeah.
Felt like it should be 18.
I mean, that's 50 for three, right? So
it's 50 for three.
Okay, yeah,
It's a bargain. Still a bargain.
Yeah. Oh well, we'll see. Again, it's going to take a little bit of time. I think once things start to gel up, the Tyranids is going to be disruptive. But I think people are just going to figure out how to deal with eight Zoanthropes and 30 warriors or something.
I mean, like, the Hammerhead is looking really good at the moment, I think. Like, the Long Strike, the Boarcan, the stuff that ignores invulns.
Yeah, but I said to take out one Zoanthrope. Yeah.
Well, it's the Maliceptor as well, and the Flying Hive Tyrants, and, you know, the stuff that can just be on top of you immediately. You need to check them. You need to be like, yeah, cool. You can do that, but then, bang, this guy's going to pick you up. Like, Long Strike's just going to shoot straight through your brains.
I guess that's good. Yeah, you're going to have to plan for him.
That's right. I think it's a good thing to plan for him. I mean, I was considering, cracking out Null Zone, man. Like, this is how deep in this rabbit hole I've been since I got back from this event.
Null Zone's been good all year. I don't know how to like break that to people in a gentle way, but Null Zone has been good all year. It's just the things around Null Zone have not been the best, and now they may be good again. So by proxy, Null Zone is probably better.
Well, yeah, I loved it when Drakari was at its zenith, when, you know, because Drakari was swamping you with stuff that had like six up against shooting, but they had a four up when they got up on top of you. Things like, you know, I'm sorry, Rax had a five up, but, you know, witches and succubuses and archons. You look at the look on someone's face when you walk up to their 2+ invulnerable save archon and you roll a 7 and they're like, you now have a 0+. Here's 5 bolt guns. Yeah, your archon's dead. It was a good time.
Probably not for the Archon. Of course, Archons, I don't know an Archon that's ever like lived as long as they should.
I have seen the two extremes. The average is very rare to happen. It's either they don't fail any the entire game, or it's like the first three that they fail with their 2+.
Yeah, that seems about right. So with Null Zone, like I said, being able to shut off invulnerable saves, that is something that is, again, I feel strongly about it. It's been good all year. Been good since it's been printed, but it hasn't had enough of the codex to be able to hang, to be in the position to where you can make the most of it.
It's true.
And we're probably in a position now. And I'm glad you brought it up, because I'd almost forgotten about Null Zone.
I mean, the same goes for the Chaos Power. What's it called? Death X?
Death X, yeah.
Very, in a very good position.
Yeah, so like, what is the best thing to get in there? Then, like, are, you know, still see people taking dreadnoughts. Like, what goes around Null Zone at this point?
My favorite place for it is in Blood Angels. It's in an aggressive army, especially one that can double move. So you can, Wings of Sanguinius, does that only go on the caster? Never mind. Question for another time. but it's for when you don't have to use it reactively. Because when you can use it aggressively, it's all on your terms. When you have to use it reactively, when someone's pressuring you, chances are they can plan for it more effectively. They can have a deny in range, or they can, you know, have some stuff in there. They can, instead of using a thing that cares about Null Zone, they'll use, you know, Terminator or stuff with a 2+ or 3+ save, or without an invulnerable entirely. So you've just brought a wasted power. So you want to put it in a place where you can use it to apply pressure on your opponent. You can use it aggressively.
I don't think it's going to be wasted, Dale. I mean, every army, we're talking about things that are including things that have some type of invulnerable state, whether it be Terminators, you know, whether it be a Swarm Lord.
Yep. Flyrants and stuff. It can be a good deterrent against something like a Swarm Lord. Something like a Flying Hive Tyrant. And I think that's a really good place for it. But usually, if that's the case, they'll be like, well, I'm going to try and put pressure on your Libby with things like Ravenous, things like Warriors. You're going to have to keep him away from my Flying Hive Tyrant. You're getting a Death Leap. Or the Flyrant's just going to scoot around and go to the other side of the table. It's just going to go the opposite direction. What you want to do is be able to go like, oh, here's my Libby, and he's going to come get you. And he's going to sidle up right next to those Zoanthropes and try and force his power through. And, you know, you might not get it off. Like, you might legitimately, that's the issue with the power in this kind of thing. A lot of the armies that use invulnerable saves the most are usually on Psykers, funnily enough. They go kind of hand in hand.
We're talking about Thousand Sons and Grey Knights, also pretty good at doing things.
Exactly right. And so whether it's worth investing to you is up to you. I know there's a Blood Angels Libby that can get +2 to cast. And I think that's probably the best place for it. And EG leans into what I'm saying about using it aggressively to go and make sure that your other assets do a better job. You know, Sanguard get to do what they do. Vanguard Vets, Death Company get to do what they do because your opponent doesn't have an invulnerable save anymore.
Yeah, Vanguard Vets looking stronger and stronger. And I admit that I've been a holdout of having the fully equipped multiple Vanguard Vet squads because I've always got Sanguinary Guard to fall back on. And it feels almost dirty not taking the Sanguinary Guard when you can take them.
Agreed. I think they're one of the best. I think that in all of Space Marines, in all every Space Marine unit, Sanguard are like in the top three best units in all of Space Marines. They're so good.
Yeah, but you know, I guess staying on topic with Null Zone, you bring up a good point. Is that it's difficult to get it off in the right position and then have everything lined up right there. You really need multiple pieces all synced up together. That's not a bad design, but it definitely ups the skill curve a bit.
Mm. And you want to play it in an army where if you don't get it off, or it gets, you know, 4+ denied by a Black Templar player or whatever, your army still does a good work. Like, you know, you don't want it to be, which is kind of how I feel about when it's paired with shooting assets rather than melee assets. I know I've got something similar to it in my Dark Angels called the Reliquary of the Repentant. And it turns any invulnerable save to a 5+. So even if you've got a 3+, it goes to a 5+. Felt a lot better when three pluses were on every storm shield, but it's still pretty good. It functions kind of as a minus one. But the only reason I'm able to use it aggressively is because I can spend two CP to, after I declare a charge and fight with the unit, to bounce it out of combat before it gets swung back on. If you were to put out a Libby that doesn't have that ability, you'd essentially be trading the piece for a one use only, and you'd have to put it out there before you know if you're getting the power off. Hence, I think you need to accompany it with support units, aggression, and just go get them.
Yeah, pretty solid advice. It's one to consider. Like if you were on the fence about taking a librarian because of you didn't want to rule yourself out of, you know, being able to take a Poor of the Witch as a secondary or something. I think the benefits of the Null Zone are going to outweigh that trade-off.
Hot tip for everybody. A Poor of the Witch will be a trap. 80% of the time now, unfortunately, because all the units that you used to be able to just be like, I can pick up five Strike Marines and get a couple of points for a Boar the Witch. Your opponent is just going to be like, oh, he took a Boar the Witch. Well, this tighter convergence that I was going to be in to make all my damage better, we're just going to stay tighter shadow all game. And you're going to get a third less points than you would have gotten. So whereas you could have seen it as being like, yeah, if we just play a little bit of a trading game, I'll get like 9 to 12 points on a boar, just knock that down by a third. You're going to get 6 to 9 points on a boar now instead. So you have to actually weigh up whether there's a better option now.
So there you go.
Let alone T-Suns. Just put it out there. T-Suns just don't die. I don't care if it's Rubik Marines, Scarab Occults, they just don't die, man.
This is what I'm talking about. I think like a Poor of the Witch is going to be a lot less attractive. And so consider putting those psychers in your army list, because I think the benefit of having them for whatever reason, even if it is just giving yourself a deny or two opportunity, you're probably worth taking. Sorry, those players that play factions that don't get psyched. You know, this is, I think what people need to hear is like what is actually changing? What is the practicalness of what is changing in it? And then what will make it into your list? What model should you be building? And I think breaking out those librarians is where it's at.
Well, you want to have some say, don't you? You don't want to just be on the receiving end of multiple Craftworld or Tyranid or T-Sun or Grey Knight psychic phases without any interaction.
I mean, plenty of us do it. You know, what are you trying to say? I mean, Paul's over there giving us pity apologies. The rest of us, I mean, we're just trying to play our game. You guys keep telling us we have to participate in the psychic phase. We don't have to. I'll prove it.
As true as that is. And you got to be able to make up for it. And I think that, you know, the extra attacks and fighting twice certainly helps. But, you know, with almost all the Eldari lists that we're seeing, like Craftworld list, are having like 4 or 5 psychers in it. We know Tyranids are going to have psychers around every corner. You know, I just don't know if these, like the Iron Hands with one opportunity to block of power is going to cut it anymore.
Eldari, I mean, it sounds like 4 or 5 psychers. Most of them have about 4 wounds. Just bring more snipers, right?
You bring up a point. I think there was an aversion. If you couldn't go psyker heavy, that you just didn't bring them at all because you were concerned about that one secondary. And I think it's time to free ourselves from that shackle. And maybe having just a pocket psyker is not a bad thing anymore. But we'll see. See how that works out. See what actually makes it in list. I think it's just fun to be able to revisit these things and talk about them like with some fresh eyes, knowing that 1,000 Suns are going to be on top tables. That almost sounds weird to say.
It does. I'm happy about it, though.
Yeah.
Well, there are a couple of factions that didn't get much of anything. Actually, they got kind of hurt by omission in this data slate. And the two that spring to mind to me are Demons and Orcs. I really want to know where they're at. I'd love some Orc players, Demon players in the chat to just be like, hey, this is what we think is going to be good for this, you know, next couple of month or two. This is where I'm excited to play. Because I'm struggling to get my head around where to start with those factions at the moment.
That's a good point. Like, how do Orcs, you know, with kind of the 1-2 punch that they've gotten, although they're still doing pretty well out there with Meganobs and Killrigs.
Oh, yeah, I don't expect them to be in freefall. I'm just trying to figure out, is there any what changes they need to make, if any?
It is a good call to action as Orc players, because they're typically very loyal to the faction. Like, what are you working with nowadays?
Oh, they're one of the great factions for always finding a way, like, because they're just, Orc players are just so ridiculously dedicated.
Yeah, I dig that. Well, let's take a break. We will come back and talk about a hobby segment. And then during that time, during the period of listening for our sponsors, you know, formulate your orc plans. Let us know what they are. We'll see you in a minute.
See ya.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Thanks for checking out our sponsor. That means a whole lot. So I teased at the first part of the show about some hobby tips, like five tips that I know I said, you know, no money, no talent, no excuses. That was, dang, you know, how it's framed, but I kind of feel that way.
I'm in this post and I don't like it.
Well, because there are things that we can do that are, don't, you know, well, we're already, you know, you already got your paints, you already got your brushes, you already got your models. So of course you spend a little bit, but there are things you can do and focus on that will really improve your output, like your results. And I think it's easy to lose sight of this stuff. So I want to bring up number one. I'm going to start at the very beginning. Clean your mold lines. Remove your mold lines. That is so big. I will say that there's like nothing, like when you're being critical of yourself and you take the picture of your model, you're looking at it and you discover that, crap, I forgot to clip that little bit, that little bit of sprue. It's on the bottom of his pouch. No one's never going to see it, but I know it's there. And every time I look at this model, I'm going to feel that way.
It's the worst.
Yeah. And sometimes you miss them on the helmets, you know, of like Space Marines or something like that. And you feel like you're just going to undo a bunch of work if you clean it. But the time to clean the mold line, and we've said this before, is when you see it. What I do is I put the models together. And I use plastic glue to assemble plastic models. I've gotten in the habit of that. And I've only been doing that in the last several years. And it takes a little bit longer to set. So you can't really manipulate the model until the glue cures, you know, just a little bit. But I like the hold it has, especially if I'm, you know, I play with the models. So I enjoy the plastic glue and the fact that it's a permanent bond, where super glue isn't always. But I'll assemble the model. And then if I have the time, I will, of course, do a first pass as I'm assembling it, cleaning the mold lines. But before I prime it, whenever that is, before I prime it, I look at each model again to see if I've missed any mold lines. And if I have, I try to clean them right then. And it really improves the finished product. Something at the very base layer of the miniature. But this leaps and bounds can accelerate like the quality of your personal model.
What do you guys use to remove mold lines? I use either I've got an X-Acto knife and a scraper. And I'll use like the X-Acto to get rid of contact point stubs and then the scraper to get rid of the mold lines.
That's what I use as well. But you can do it with the X-Acto blade. It just,
yeah.
You know, if you're trying to do it just without purchasing any additional tools, you probably have an X-Acto knife.
I just use X-Acto knife.
I mean, you can just use a box cutter if you really needed to. Maybe get a smaller one than the big fished ones. But yeah, you can get away with it pretty cheap.
I do have the Games Workshop seam scraper. But even like, yeah, if you were to get like a off-brand seam scraper, I think they're about the same price. Like that's, for some reason, it's a hunk of metal. Like, so it's going to cost you about the same no matter what. But I do use the tool pretty frequently. And can
I've seen people use these like little, they're like sanding strips to do this, but they're very like thin and they're kind of in like a foam core kind of deal. So they can like fit into small spaces. I've been thinking about maybe giving that a try for some sort of like, sometimes you get that mold line that's like in an armpit, but you can still see it.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I was thinking about maybe trying those. Have you guys ever tried those?
You mean like almost like an emery board type?
It is, but it's really, really thin. And it's like, yeah, it's kind of like foamy.
I think those come in, like you can get them in kits of different sizes. I think I know what you're talking about.
But you never used it before?
I've never used it, no.
I might have to experiment.
Oh, let us know, because like you're right. Sometimes they're in very tricky spots, and I typically like try to root those out with the X-Acto blade tip. But having a better solution might be cool. But look, seriously, don't let like any extra gear stop you taking the time to remove the mold lines. You know, it will improve your work. Some people probably already do some of these things, but they might not do all these things. The next one tip I've got does require a little bit of purchase, but I guess maybe not, is clean your brushes. And I use brush soap, but I kind of have to imagine that almost like any bar soap.
Mm. If you're talking about doing this with natural fiber bristles like sable, I think you can use shampoo, but you have to condition them after.
Yeah.
I don't think you want to use like actual bar soap because it tends to be quite like it tends to be too harsh on the bristles.
Yeah, you're probably exactly right. Like, don't listen to me on that. But I use this, it's called Master's Brush Soap. And I don't use it as often as I should, but it definitely extends the life of my brushes. Because what you'll get, like one of the reasons that their brushes go haywire is paint dries in the parts of the brush you can't see.
The ferrule. Is that how you say it? It's like F-E-R-R-U-L-E. How do you pronounce that?
We're going to go with
it. I can spell it.
Well, I'm going to take your word for it. But, you know, you get those, take care of your brushes. That's really the thing here. And you can extend the life of it. And what you really want is like a sharp point most of the time on your brush. And if you don't clean out the interior bristles, then you basically know you lose that sharp point is the next time you go to do it. And so you're fighting against yourself and the brush. Like the brush is not an extension of you. You are in competition with the brush. And that is not great for your end result. If y'all have a different experience, let me know.
I actually don't like natural bristle brushes. So I just use really inexpensive, like bulk synthetic brushes. So once they don't hold the tip anymore, then I trim them and make them dry brushes.
There you go. Yeah, that's another thing. Don't be afraid to actually trim. Like if you've got a wild, like one brush has a wild hair.
I keep a pair of cuticle scissors at my station for that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Get rid of it.
Yeah.
And again, when you're painting, especially like if you're just following box art or if you're looking at a tutorial or just going at it your own way or whatever, you don't want to be fighting against it. Because you only have a certain amount of hobby time. You might only have 20 minutes to try to do something. You don't want to make it harder for yourself. You want to get the most out of that 20 minutes. So taking care of your brush will help with that. And it's beyond that extra, like it's not just a chore. You are really helping yourself when you do that. Tip number three, use a palette and thin your paints. And I'm going to get like real broad on what a palette is. For years and years and years and years and years, I just used a piece of plastic that came in a kit. Like a little plastic tray. I just used the lid of that as my palette for years. A piece of Tupperware works. Those little like El Cheapo Ziploc things. If you get like any non-porous surface would probably work as a palette. And not have you pull in paint right out of the pot.
I take this to like a whole nother level of cheapness. And my favorite Chinese takeout restaurant has like the perfect containers to make a palette out of.
Oh my God.
I literally make my palette out of trash, people.
That's okay. That's right on brand with this segment. No cash, no excuses.
For the longest time, I used the lunchbox lid from my lunchbox I had in primary school as a kid. I just keep my paints in it, and the lid, it was my palette for like a couple of years.
I mean, that's okay. Really, you want to thin your paints down right out of the pot. And, take them out of the pot, thin them down with just a little clean water, and then the paint spread in a more predictable way. And again, you're not battling with the brush or the paint at this point, so you're going to get more out of your hobby time. You'll get better results.
It also question gives you the opportunity to try different techniques as well, because I'm not sure that you could learn how to glaze if you don't have some sort of palette.
You want to talk about glazing a little bit?
Oh, yeah. So glazing is where you thin down the paint a lot, and then you're applying really thin, watery layers onto the model. And with each subsequent layer, you're adding more pigment in a place where you would determine you want a blend or you want a highlight. And you have to get your paint really, really thin for that. So I'm not sure you can do that if you don't have a palette.
It used to be the only way you could paint white or yellow was to glaze it before technology caught up to our expectations.
So nice. You can actually paint yellow and not feel like you had to commit, you know, your entire essence to it. Thinning your paints. Yeah, I granted, you know, some of like the air paints and that kind of stuff, they come a little bit thin. I actually don't get the air paints that often unless I know I'm specifically going to be trying to run the airbrush. But thin
question,
your paints.
What other things do you guys thin your paints with? I use, I got Vallejo thinner, I have Lamy and Medium, and I use water. But it was weird, yeah, because I used to copy a lot of Duncan's tutorials back in the day. And now, you know, of course, I copy some of the newer G-Dub artists' tutorials. And they use far less than mine, and it dilutes far more than mine does.
Special painter's water, use, like, man.
They use distilled water, or is there some special crazy water I don't know about?
I might be like betraying how sophisticated of a painter I am. I literally use whatever I was drinking. So if it's like my tap water, I use that if I've got like a little carbonated or tonic water that I'm drinking, like
you put it in a separate container, right?
I put it in the palette. I put it in my wet palette, and then I use the water inside the wet palette to thin my paint. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So different environments will have like different humidity, and your paint will be a different consistency, could be every single time you open that lid. So the paints that you're seeing, and that's where it gets tricky watching some of these tutorials. Not that's the only place it gets tricky, is that their environment is slightly different than yours. And so you might have to do something slightly different to get the same results.
Are you finding consistently, Adam, that all paints aren't thinning the same as on the tutorials, or is it certain colors for you?
It's usually all paints. I mean, I think what Paul just said was that, hey, Adam, Australia is dry. Just deal with it.
I also live in a desert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that is very relevant. That is very true. Like, you got to take your surrounds into account. Like, you know, in Australia, I think you have to use your different air pressure on your airbrush, because the paint's more likely to dry quicker and therefore you need to push it through quicker. So there's, you know, there's a whole bunch of things you got to take into consideration. At least so I've been told. I use mostly for my, you know, anything apart from base coatings, I use either air paints. I use either G-Dub or the Vallejo or the P3 or the whatever brand of air paint. But usually it's pre-thin stuff. And I still thin it down because that's just how I need it to get where I want it.
Yeah. So asking specifically what I use, I've used the mediums too, but most of the time I just use water. The mediums are really good for when it's absolutely mission critical that you don't change the consistency or texture of the paint. Mm. And I'm not good enough most of the time where that matters.
I usually thin down with medium when I want more control, when I think I'd rather use two or three coats to get where I want and know it's exactly where I want, rather than, you know, one or two and chancing it.
Yeah, it's probably solid. They do what they are supposed to do, and I definitely endorse using them if you're at the point where you either, again, don't want to be in competition with what you're trying to do, or you're looking for a very specific effect where that helps get there sooner. So, but you know, water works for water-based paints. Water works most of the time. Next bit here kind of goes without saying, but practice. You can practice for free. You probably got some miniatures. The miniatures don't mind if you paint them over again. I know it's seems like a big waste of time. You don't want to do that, but you could do that if you want to get better.
I think a lot of people worry about, like, I'm going to air quotes here, ruining their models, because they are pretty expensive and they just keep getting more expensive all the time. My favorite thing to do is to go buy the pre-primed D&D miniatures if there's something I want to practice on, because they're like $6 or $7 Canadian. So I don't even know. That must be pretty inexpensive.
Sometimes you get two models in that pack.
Right? And sometimes you can find some pretty interesting looking things that have a combination of like armor and skin and cloth. And they're just really great practice models. If there's some sort of technique that you want to practice, but you're not sure if you're there yet to do it on a GW model, I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah. Good tip. And also it's, you know, we mentioned this on the show that, you know, comparing your models to other people's models is a bit of a trap. And, you know, you don't know how many hours it took them to get that effect. You don't know how many hours it's going to take you to get there. You may come out the gate at a higher skill level than they started at, but yet they've put in 1,000 hours or whatever. And so now they're better than you, like in your mind, but just more important that you just do it and paint and practice. No one has to see all you could just show them your finished work, but you don't get there without actually putting in the time, which in the days of social media and people taking pictures and, you know, hobby blogs and that kind of stuff, I think it is easy to lose sight of that. So I just want to point it out here again. It is something absolutely free, and you don't have to be good to practice. That's why it is practice. Tip the fifth, use the color wheel. Do not ignore color theory. If you don't know where to go on a miniature and you know you want it to look like what is like classically good, the color wheel is a good place to start, because it's like science as to what colors look fine. I don't want to say good, because that's like a judgment, you know, or look classically well received by the viewer is on the color wheel.
I feel like that's really great advice, but I feel like sometimes it's hard to take, because I'm looking, my husband has like a color wheel at his painting station. It's got all these like moving parts and stuff, and it's a really cool tool, but there are a ton of apps online that can help you pick colors. And I use one for almost every single project that I undertake.
You could just Google color wheel and you get whatever the most basic thing is. It's I'm saying just anything. If you are stuck somewhere and don't know why your models aren't popping the way you maybe want them to or expect them to, there are resources. So that's, I think that's where you're going.
Yeah, for sure. So like I use a free app. It's just called Color Lab, and you just pick a color that you think looks rad. So I don't know, maybe you're like, I love Xandri Dust. That's the color that you want the majority of your army to be, but you have no idea where to go from there. You can literally take a picture of the bottom of the container of Xandri Dust. It'll tell you what its actual hexadecimal code is, but then there's a little harmony button that you can pick, and then it will show you all of the different ways that are like generally well received to pair that color with other colors.
Oh, that's cool.
It is really cool, and it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it. Highly recommend.
Does it like give you some opinions on what would be like similar colors, like different shades,
yep.
or and then what would be a contrast?
Yep. So it'll tell you like, and each one of these has like a few different versions of it. So I can actually pull it up and tell you, but it'll definitely tell you like if you wanted to keep it all sort of like in Xandri Dust shades, it'll show you like which colors to sort of aim for. So I just have to pick any old color. Let's pick that one. Harmony. So it says complementary, split complementary, analogous accent, triadic square, tetradic plus, tetradic minus, clash, 5-tone, and 6-tone.
I hope there's pictures of those because I do
not. Yeah, I know what you guys, but that was very helpful.
Yeah.
You just pick one. So you say for my harmony, I usually pick something like split complementary. It's 3 colors. So if I picked, say, like Warboss Green, it'll tell me that the colors that I should sort of be aiming for to go with it are like a pink that's closer to the purple side and a red that's like perfectly in between sort of like pink and orange.
No, I dig it. You know, in the, to change it as another resource, the Games Workshop paint app, you know, you can sometimes just look up by model and you'll get several different options about, and it'll tell you what color to use if you're curious about it. But you know, sticking with the theme of these things are low cost and you don't have to necessarily be a, you know, a color scientist to figure it out. These resources out there are available at no cost. And it is just science, like of what colors look pretty good.
And I don't like to think about it. So I like free resources.
Yeah. Like I learned that blue and brown go together pretty well. I would have never picked that originally, I don't think, without seeing it. Oh, well, that ain't too bad.
Hey, Red, you would be really happy to know that the Citadel app by Games Workshop, I actually have that one.
I'm really glad. I was going to throw that one in there because I like it a lot, actually. I like that it shows, not only does it show Citadel models, right, so you can see how some of that goes on. It does do a pretty good job, I feel, of showing complementary and then some of like highlighting techniques and whatnot. And it's also free and it's another amazing piece of technology that I'm pretty confident Adam doesn't know exists or refuses to use.
I have a bonus tip that I want to throw in here. I want to throw into the conversation is that when you're watching tutorials and stuff and highlights, you know, there's people always suggest like a different color, another color to highlight your whatever color, the base color you just painted. But in a pinch, you can get by with the base color, a dark wash, and then that same color again as the highlight. And don't let anybody tell you you can't.
For sure, man. My Cadians are entirely built on this premise.
Caliban Green, Nolan Oil?
Sorry, Castellan Green, Nolan Oil, or Agrax. It's usually Agrax because I got Xandri Dust as the khaki, and I'm just doing like, I ain't doing 2 freaking shades on these little dudes. It's Agrax from top to bottom, and then re-highlight the green with the same color. And then like the sergeants get edged on, you know, with, I think it's Lothen Forest.
All right.
I have a question for you guys just because I'm like really curious. Besides black, is there a paint color that you find you use on almost every model?
That is, I've got kind of like go-tos.
Well, I mean, Paul lives in a palace of Mephiston Red, so it's probably that for him.
I assume that didn't count either. I gave myself some other restrictions.
That is your black.
I will say probably like it's either like Moot Green, believe it or not, or Retributor armor finds its way into most a lot of miniatures.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say Ironbreaker.
Mm.
Nice.
Yeah, I was going to say a Dark Silver. It might not be Lead Belcher, but it's a Lead Belcher equivalent. That kind of color finds its way on everything.
So mine is Baneblade Brown. Ooh. Because I use it for the base coat of like Teeth and Tusks. I use it for the base coat of Skulls. I have been known to mix it with different shades like Xandri Dust, which is another of my favorites, and Cadian Flesh Tone to make flesh tones. Yeah, so Baneblade Brown is like a color I can never be without.
That's a good. It is a good color. It also good. It's a good like base to if you want to go up to like a light marble. Like a real light brown marble. It's a good base color, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is a layer, so it can be a little bit hard to work with if you're doing like large panels. But I find I'm mostly doing like skulls and little things with it, and I use it for my base coat for anything that's going to end up being like an ivory color.
I found myself only rotating around like the several two or three brown colors, just period. And I made a concerted effort over the last several months, like up my brown game, like to have better leathers that I've in just like brown tints and tones that I've had in the past.
Have you found any like unexpected winners?
There's the recipe for the red leather that the Games Workshop uses on Custodes is is pretty good. And it starts with, you know, different colors than you probably would have thought to use in the first place. And you eventually get up to like a red highlight, but it looks like brown leather.
Interesting. Is that the one that's like Mournfang and like Scrag Brown and like kind of in the orangey kind of colors?
Yeah. And Scrag, I use some, like you can thin, speaking of the mediums, you can thin that down with medium and it makes the almost like the perfect rust.
Interesting. Because I usually dry brush Troll Slayer orange for rust.
You would probably still go up to the Troll Slayer on this, but it's like a really, it's not that, you know, that sci-fi bright rust. It's a real dark and gritty, you know, it looks like old rust.
Do you make a wash out of it then?
Yeah.
Essentially?
Yeah, basically.
Oh, and then you like sponge it on or something?
I just go in the recesses. You could probably do more with it, but I've just done it around the recesses.
Interesting.
That Scrag Brown is like a very versatile color. More versatile, yeah, than I would consider again. But I found myself, like you're talking about, you know, using the same colors or using a color that goes on everything. I found myself like, well, I've got these, you know, three pots of brown. I've got my, potential base coat or base color, and then what I always layer it with and what I always highlight it with. So I've tried to expand that recently. Yeah, we'll see if it, it's fun, something to do. But that's it. That's the hobby segment. I know it was a bit of a long hobby segment, but it's been a while since we've done like a true beginner type paint thing. And, you know, maybe there's something there that even experienced painters or let's say longtime hobbyist might be able to benefit from.
Like a garbage palette.
Hey, you can, what is it? Upcycle?
Upcycle.
Is that?
Yes.
Is that the term?
Well, I think you'd actually have to do something to the garbage to upcycle it. I'm just reusing it.
But that's okay. I know folks that paint right out of the pot, and maybe if they're in a, whatever the pressure has to be or whatever, the air pressure to maybe not make the paints a little thicker. Obviously not in Australia. And it's very humid here in Georgia. It's not here in Georgia either. I don't know where it would be.
I do want to preface this by saying that like my husband paints straight out of the pot and his painting is amazing.
It really is.
So if you try, I do suggest trying a palette, but if it just really isn't for you, then there is nothing wrong with painting straight from the pot.
Well, I think these are things that if you find yourself wanting to improve and don't know how to get there, make sure you're doing these things we just talked about. And if you are, and you know you are, then you might be ready for some higher level techniques. But if you're content with what you're doing, then don't do anything different.
I'm still reeling from the straight from the pot bit. Like I'm not sure I'm ready to continue.
Especially not after you see his stuff. This is why you can't compare yourself
yeah.
exactly
to other
right.
people's stuff.
I was like heathen. But then Tiny's like, his stuff's really good. I'm like, ah, oh, God.
Really good, and he paints really fast.
That's some dark art stuff. He's made a pact. You should be careful.
He definitely plays chaos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is not in competition with his brush or his paints. Unlike me, I feel like I'm in a bitter struggle.
Oh, he's like a Zen painter, right? He just like achieves Zen, and he like goes to his happy place, and he creates these magnificent works of art. They're very stylized, but his understanding of like light and shade is very good, and I just really enjoy his painting.
Yeah. There's like some friends occasionally they'll bring stuff over for me to paint, and you know, sometimes they'll hang out while I'm doing it. It's actually my preferred way. And there's a lot of foul language involved, and they're like, you know, are you okay? It's like, should I not bring them? And like, no, this would be the same no matter if I'm painting your models or my own. This is my process.
Not Zen, then.
Pretty much the opposite. But yeah, these are things that help me. Hopefully, if they help people out there, that's cool. Or if you find you're already doing all that kind of stuff, you're probably ready for the next level. Don't be afraid to get out of that comfort zone a little bit. But I think some of it just takes time. Some of it takes a little bit of effort, and then practice, and you get where you want to be. Pretty soon, you know, you start with just a unit, and then you have an army. And I feel like that's kind of the way it goes. You just kind of like I try to, you know, set some, whenever I'm painting, I try to set some goals for myself, you know, to try to get X amount of done a day or a month or something like that. But even that is not necessary. Like, don't, it's supposed to be fun. Don't stress yourself out about it.
I like to have a goal like that. Like, okay, I'm going to get these 20 Noblars done in like, you know, 2 weeks or whatever. But then I like to have like a little period in between where I sort of like loosey goosey, just paint what I want. And then I'll like make another goal. So I kind of like reset back and forth. And that's what really works for me.
That's okay. I mean, really it's just whatever, like one needs to get this stuff completed. You know, if you need to trick yourself or you need a deadline or you need a tournament coming up to do it, then register for a tournament. That means, you know, you have to have your models done by that Saturday.
That's like the single best motivator for me to actually paint stuff. Yeah.
I'm kind of the same way. Like I like to have that. But at the same time, I just know that, you know, I will eventually like get a good mat on and get through, you know, some of the chores, the hobby chores that I consider. But it's only like certain colors are my chore. I've talked about those before. I won't bore you all with that at this moment, but let me know what y'all think. You know, are these things you're already doing? These tips, maybe the first time you heard it, you know, leave some comments, hit us with some 5-star reviews, and like, share, subscribe. That's my soft sell for this week.
Oh, I feel like we really dropped the ball on that one as a team.
On the plugging?
We did so well last week.
That was good.
I didn't even think of it.
Like an orchestra, you know, it's like everything was just firing off right in time. And here we are. And had to soft sell it here at the end of the show. Well, that's our show,
everybody. Yeah. Let's do it. Start over, guys. Delete it.
Yeah,
do it again.
One more time. What's more from the top?
Ruined.
What's the feeling in this? We might not have a show next week, depending on travel schedules and time. But if we don't, tune in to coverage from the U.S. Open in Seattle. Going to be doing some streaming from there. I would like it if y'all come check us out, hang out in the chat, let us know what's up. Also, Warhammerfest is next weekend. Who knows what we're going to see? Very excited about that. It's an online event.
Yeah, exciting.
Yeah, really looking forward to see what's happening with that. Especially, I mean, it's just been hit after hit after hit. And then, yeah, if you don't hear from this show, we'll be back the week after. Hopefully, we hear from us every week, though. But that's it this week. I've had a great time talking hobby and chasing the meta.
Yeah, good times.
We'll see y'all next week.
Tenets demand you tune in next week for the greater good, of course.